If I write an email, you don't know me, and I'm asking for your time, everybody's busy in this world.
Yep.
Why are you going to give me your time? And so I think for any new SDR, whether public or private sector, if you read an email or if you listen back to a call and you can't answer that question for yourself, then how can the person who has no idea who you are answer that question and say to themselves, I'm going to give you time?
Hi, I'm Mark Gagne.
And I'm Chris Corcoran, and you're listening to Tech Sales is for Hustlers. Tech Sales for Hustlers is a podcast where we catch up with Memory Blue alums and reminisce about their start in high-tech sales with us.
Let's go get some, Corcoran.
Gagne, you know I'm ready.
Yasin Alawa in the house. What's up, man?
Hey, nothing much, Mark. How are you?
The pride of Algeria.
Hopefully after the podcast, they still see me in that light, right?
The multilingual. The Kobe Bryants.
We don't have many people in the history of business ever who speak two or three languages. This guy speaks four.
Yeah.
That's a talent.
That is impressive.
But that's not his biggest talent. We're going to get into that.
Yes.
So, Yasin, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's been a little while. It's been a long time, as my Eric B. and Rakim like to say. 2015 was your departure.
Yeah.
October 2015.
Yep.
We're coming up on 7 years, Corcoran.
Shit.
We're getting old. But with age comes experience and stories to talk about. Yeah. So before we get into yours, let the audience know, and Chris and I, fill us in on like a little who you are, where you're from, where you grew up, the little backgrounds. We connect with you a little bit on a personal level. People can relate, those who are listening.
Yeah, absolutely. So Yasin, right? My ethnicity and my background is from Algeria. I've got two parents that were born actually in Algeria when it wasn't even independent yet. So they're actually older than the country itself.
Wow.
And so, you know, they worked
what
hard.
What country was it before?
It was colonized by the French. So, you know, they're born into a French territory, right? And the revolution was happening. So the revolution for Algeria's independence was happening when they were born into the world. So they were born into that kind of instability, right? And so with that, they really, you know, busted their behinds to first go to the UK and then come here to the US. And so I'm a first generation, you know, American Algerian, born and raised here in the DMV, the Washington, D.C. area.
Where were you born?
So funny enough, I'm a typical DMV transplant. I'm born in D.C., I grew up in Maryland, and then I went to college in Virginia. So I tackled all three just for good, you know, measure.
Welcome back to it. But now you live in Maryland.
Yep. So now living again in Maryland, although I lived downtown for close to a decade, right? And so when I was actually coming to Memory Blue, part of my interview process was like, hey, you don't have a car. How are you going to get here, right? And it was right when the metro was opening in Tysons, right? So
let's back up. Sorry, because I did jump ahead, which is I'm proud to do. Let's go back to, so you grew up born in
D.C.
D.C.
Yep. I went to a Montessori school just to kind of learn the English language, right? Yeah. And then from there, I went to the French International School.
What was the language spoken in your house when you were growing up?
Oh, it was a multitude,
really?
Right? I mean, you know, as you grow up, you try to, you're living here, so you're heavy on English. But my parents really wanted to force the French, the Arabic, to make sure that we didn't lose that. So, yeah. I mean, in one sentence at our house on one, you know, weekday evening, you could hear three languages in that same
when
sentence.
Your father was upset at you or your mother,
It was Arabic.
Let you up a bit.
They went down. They went back to the mother tongue where they had all the insults down, right? And they could really go at you. So
you're really upset at someone. Well, I want to give them a shout out before. Like Chris and I got to work with you for a while. We've stayed in touch with you over the years. You've been great to the business. You've been a great alum, and you were great when you were here. Shout out to your parents.
Yeah.
They've done a great job, as far as I can tell. All right, so keep going back to where you grew up. Tell us about that. Montessori school?
Yeah, Montessori school and the French International School, right? And, you know, made a ton of awesome friends. I think when I went through it, I kind of hated it because I was the only kid that went to school till 5:30, you know, most days, right? Whereas everybody's in the park playing around. And so, but, you know, like most of my best friends now, my network, et cetera, I mean, it consists heavily of some of those folks that I met there. And
let's talk about that school.
Yeah.
So because people thought, with the French International School, people are like, what the hell is he talking about?
Yeah.
Break it down.
Yeah, so it's French International School, Lycée Beauchambeau in French. It's in Bethesda, Maryland. And there you're going to have, I mean, it's a melting pot of cultures, right? You've got sons of ambassadors, a lot of World Bank group, you know, parent kids or kids of World Bank parents, if you will, right?
Yep.
And all of the NGOs, all of the international organizations. And then you've just got folks, right, that are living here, maybe working for private sector companies and have their kids, and they're coming from kind of similar backgrounds as me. So still a small school though, right? My graduating class was 120, and that was one of the biggest ones in the school history.
And it was, what's in French?
Lycée Rochambeau.
The whole thing's in French? You go to school.
Gotcha. Yeah.
All the classes in French?
Pretty much most of them, except for actually, like, you know, your Spanish class. You could do languages. So Spanish, German was one, Italian was another. And then you had English and American history. Those two were in English. Other than that, everything was in French. So when I went to college, I was great at math. But my kind of struggles initially was, I just need to know what that word is in French that you're telling me to calculate, right? Like integer, right?
Yeah.
Like that word was absolutely foreign to me going into college, right? So there was a bit of a transition where I had to learn like the English concepts for what I already knew, but in another language.
And why did you have to go to school till 5:30?
It's just the French curriculum.
Because they're not known for working long hours.
Yeah, you know, they work you hard during your youth going through your educational process, and then they're very notorious for striking on any given occasion. So you're not wrong there.
No strike in high school. No, but I'm sorry. Why go to school at 5:30?
It's just the curriculum, right? Okay. The curriculum brought you till then. I mean, you know, we get our high school diploma after 11th grade. Mm-hmm. Some people will just leave and go to college. But the whole point that your parents are really paying that money is for you to get your international and your French baccalaureate. I mean, your whole senior year is just studying for that. And I mean, I'm talking, they could give you a one pager and tell you to write 8 pages on what the author was trying to say in like the 1700s, right? Yeah. And there's no right or wrong answer. They don't know what the author was trying to say either, right? But so there was a lot of different things. And, you know, looking back on it now, I love it, right? Because, you know, I went to college and I knew a lot of things that a lot of folks just had never learned before. And so it gave me kind of an extra step, if you will, I felt, over others where, you know, I wasn't the best student, but then I was like, dang, but like, I know a lot of things, right? Yeah. And so that kind of got me to say in college, like, all right, let me kind of grind. Let me get some good grades. Let me get my business degree and let me get out into the world, right? Yeah. So, you know, I do look back on it with absolute positive thoughts. I stay close with some of the teachers, et cetera. So, and now I coach there. Yeah. So I guess I wasn't that bad that they brought me back as a contractor. So.
That's right.
What are you coaching?
Soccer. So I've had a beautiful game, Corcoran.
Come on, the
game that the world abides by.
It's not a gross game.
Yeah, exactly. But I've been coaching a team that are now, they're going into seventh grade. They're 13-year-olds, but I've had them since they were seven.
Oh.
So it's been a fun ride. And it's super rewarding. And it's also a great way to just turn off, right, from what you normally do. Uh-huh. Sales is not, you know, you have great days and then you have brutal days, right? And so it's, you go and you train these little kids that are just so happy to be there and just so happy to play and learn. And, you know, you exit and whatever happened in your day, if you had a rough day, I mean, it's not important at that point, right? You get that bigger picture sense from that.
When you do get upset at the players in your team, what language do you yell at them in?
It depends on the player. It depends on the player. No, and I say that because, you know, me too, right? Growing up, you know, you have everything in French. By the time you got to sports or your team, it's English, right? And so some kids want to talk in English and I'll talk to them in English. Some, you know, are new to the country. And so they don't actually speak English yet. Yeah. They're learning. And so I'll talk to them in French. You know, I'll meet them where they're most comfortable.
Yeah. So going back, speaking of kids, let's go back to you as a kid. What were you like as a kid a little like? This whole, you're in tech sales now, working with Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
But did the sales thing turn up? Or what did you think you wanted to be when you're going to French international school with you know, some of your cronies?
No, I was a terror, right? And in a way where it's like, I had so much energy. I was bouncing off of the walls. I mean, you guys could probably see it now, right? I can't even sit straight here.
You worked here with that, remember?
Yeah, so I've got loads of energy. So I was always, you know, active. It wasn't, you couldn't just sit there and relax if you needed to watch me. It was hands-on, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I always knew that I had a business entrepreneurial sense that I wanted to go into something like this. To give you guys a story, right, is like early on I found just on the ground downtown, right, like a yes, we're open, sorry, we're closed sign. And I hung that up on the fireplace. And with my Hot Wheels, I ran a Hot Wheel rental business. And, you know, if you look at it now, my business practices might have been illegal. Because what I did is, so my parents would never come home before 7 p.m. So we would close at 6. So they couldn't return that Hot Wheel for multiple days. And so there's late fees then getting attached. And so, you know, I was not only were they buying me the Hot Wheel, but then I was renting out the Hot Wheel and buying another 6 Hot Wheels for my fleet off of that one rental, right? So, I mean, it was definitely some deceptive business practices going on over there, but kind of just got me going to like, hey, I'd love to own a business. I'd love to run something. I'd love to just, you know, be able to kind of take bets, take chances, fail fast and learn from them and just kind of have a full business experience in my life. So that's kind of what led me to business school and then, you know, to you guys, right?
Yeah. So what was the last time you returned to Algeria or actually went to Algeria?
Yeah. So summer 2018, okay. You know, growing up, it was yearly, and very early on, I just get shipped out there. Right. So that was how I learned Arabic. It was, you know, hey, my parents don't have summer vacation. We don't have summer vacation like our kids do. Right.
Right.
And so they were like, all right, June 20th arrived, you're on a plane. Right. So very early on, I mean, probably by 8, 9 years old, I'm flying alone. I'm going there, you know, my uncles and my cousins will be meeting me at the airport in Algiers. And then I would stay, you know, my mom is a bit from the north, my dad from the south. So I would just ship between, you know, kind of the two sides of the family and hang out with my cousins. And for me, it was awesome because it's like you're having a sleepover every night. Your parents are like thousands of miles away. You know, your aunts and uncles are always going to spoil you. Right. And so it was fun. But so I went back yearly. And then, you know, as you grow older and stuff, you got to kind of, you know, you don't get as much PTO. You got to plan things out. So try to keep it every other year. And of course, the pandemic kind of just completely threw a nail in sort of the cadence of which I would go back and see family. But I mean, I've got a ton of extended family that still lives there.
What have your parents said in terms of how much has changed?
I mean, so much from when they were there, right? I mean, even just from like you look at smartphones and stuff. I mean, some of these people have like 3 lines, right? Like I've got cousins who have no job and 3 cell phones, 3 lines, right? And it's a completely different world where everything is connected. Uh-huh. Back then, there was no connection, right? I mean, we were not connected to, you know, some of the integral parts that we use today, the internet and some of these technological innovations that we have, right? And that's why, you know, for example, I'm so big on the field I'm in now, cryptocurrency and blockchain, right? Because anybody with a smartphone can participate in the global economy,
right?
You don't need a mailing address. You don't need a bank address or a bank account, right? And those are some of the things that kind of continue to persist today. If you want to take money out from an ATM, and by the way, those are very few and far between, you're getting shafted on the exchange rate, right? Yeah. You're probably losing 50% of your money. And so a lot of people there isn't a stable financial system to count on over there. And that is the reason that a lot of people still kind of want to leave, right? They want to find whether it's educational opportunities abroad that's then going to lead them to their careers.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Got it. All right. So you went to college locally,
yep.
Right? And what did you major in? And what did you think you wanted to do when you were in school?
Yeah. So I did a BBA, a little small focus in marketing. And so I graduated in 2013. So it was still kind of a bit tough after the crash in 2009 to find things. So that was my humbling experience to understand that what you probably learned, you might not go and do. Like I really wanted to find a marketing gig, right? Mm-hmm. And you just couldn't find anything. And so, you know, for a while I waited tables just to kind of bring in some money, right? Be able to kind of live and whatnot. But I'm still looking around. And then that's what kind of got me to create a LinkedIn and, you know, just kind of learning like, okay, there's a social media for professionals. Like I should probably get my resume on there, right? Let me see what comes of it. And, you know, I think the next story is probably the fun one with Chris here. And
before we get on to that, what happened to the Hot Wheels operation?
I cannot remember what happened. I think we
strike.
Yeah. I think I probably grew up, probably got into the N64, the regular Nintendo, played a little bit of Super Mario. And so just kind of progressed towards, all right, let me be more of a kid. Right. But I mean, I kept always reading just like business books geared towards kids, how to save money, right. How to save money in different manners. Right. And maybe grow money here, throw it into an account that's exposed to the market, right? I learned like at 9 years old what blue chip stocks are and slow consistent growth that you can get from those, right? Mm-hmm. So every time I'd make money shoveling driveways when there was a snow day or, you know, pedaling out Hot Wheels to my parents and, by the way, to all of their friends at dinner parties, that was a very, very lucrative side hustle there. You know, I'd give my dad the money and I'd be like, hey, throw that into my account, right? Throw that into my investment account. And so it slowly grew, right, to where I could use it to make, you know, once I graduated college, a down payment on an apartment.
Wow.
There you go, man.
Wow.
All right. So you're doing your thing.
Yeah.
Beginning your investment in real estate, which I know you're doing some stuff now for that, actually, based on where you live and all that jazz. But you're waiting tables. Well, what happened? Like, how did you, because you didn't know anyone who had worked here.
Technically, you
were like in touch with them.
Yeah.
They were like, hey, why don't you come work here?
Yeah, sort of thing.
What happened?
Yeah. So, you know, make a LinkedIn profile, right? Take a selfie in front of my orange apartment wall. get my picture and my face out there, right? And I say that just to say, you know what I mean? Like these days you have all these professional headshots, etc. Like just take a picture of yourself. Show your visual. Show that you're somebody that's put together. And also, you know, you humanize yourself to folks reaching out to you.
Sure.
Right. They're visualizing who they're reaching out to. And that's also, you know, part of sometimes the struggle of being an SDR, but also sometimes kind of the relief when you have a bad day, right? You don't know what these people look like.
Right.
But to go back, you know, I make that LinkedIn profile and I get a call, right? And I do not know B2B sales at this point, right? I mean, I know it exists, but I don't know about Memory Blue. I don't know anything. And Chris Corcoran is on the other line of this call. So Chris Corcoran calls me. This is November 2014. October, November 2014, let's estimate, right?
Oh, wow.
And so he's cold calling me. And actually what he's doing is he's trading Joey Cohen. Joey Cohen, who I love and continue to remain in touch with to this day, right? Joey was moving to, I guess, recruitment, right? And so Chris was running through the sheet music, just kind of training him, and I was the guy. And of course, Chris, you know, being a good, you know, seller and just knowing how to kind of build that rapport and close very quickly and not give too much, he sees that I went to the French International School, talks about Philippe Gattaz, who used to work here, right?
Philippe!
Who I, you know, I see every time I fly to London. He's a great family friend. You know, we stay very close in touch. So he built that rapport, but then didn't give me enough, you know, tip of the spear kind of thing, right? and then I think a day or two later, I was here in, well, not this new swanky, beautiful headquarters you have, but Boone and Gallows, right? On the other side of Tyson's Galleria. And I'm in there, and you know, when I get there, I realized very quickly, I had no idea what Memory Blue did. Like, I went on the website, right? I did, like, my minimal due diligence. But this is 2014, guys, right? Like, you don't have all the stuff that you have on the website today back then. And Tommy Gassman and Mark hand me a phone, and they're like, yeah, here's sheet music, and you're about to close. And I'm like, wait, what? What do I have to do? I'm calling some dude on the other side of this wall trying to close him up. What? Like, you know what I mean? And so, but, you know, it went well. And I almost loved it because it was like trial by fire. And it's also an honest assessment, right? Is this person trainable? Because I think the Memory Blue business model, right, is, hey, if you have the work ethic and you have the hustle, the grind, you know, that's all you need to bring to the table every day. You guys will take care of the rest. The process, the structure that you guys have put together will kind of, you know, jumpstart your career and also your performance here at Memory Blue. So, that is kind of how I found myself to then land at Memory Blue in early, you know, first or second week of January in 2015.
So what a great story. And it illustrates something that I've noticed is you remember this vividly.
Yeah.
I had no recollection of it whatsoever. And I think it illustrates the point that just because you don't remember doesn't mean someone else doesn't remember it.
Yeah.
And people have a big impact on one another, whether you yourself realize it or not.
100%.
That's huge, right? Yeah. You've been longer in your career now.
Yeah.
Like things you may not consider as significant are super, super important.
There's some Yassine Jr. running around there saying, like, I remember this time Yassine did this. And if he came and told you about it, you'd be like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I had no idea, right? It's one of those things where sometimes you're, whether it's performance or even just a few things you've done, right, can kind of still survive after you've left.
Right.
And that's awesome to hear.
Yeah, we're going to do a podcast with somebody who worked here when you were like on your ninth month with us, you know, towards the end. And it was my first week. And I remember like Yassine was like the baller in the office. and no, this is going to happen. And he did A, B, and C. And then I'm going to talk to you about it and you're not going to remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then to that person, that's like seared into their mind for the rest of their lives.
It's that first impression,
and it should be, right?
Yeah.
Or it could have been not even a first impression. They just remember something you did or you said.
Yeah.
So that's why you got to put more attention into what you are doing, which is hard to do when you don't have that experience and that perspective. Mm-hmm. But anyways. Okay. All right. So you ended up coming to work here.
Yeah.
All right. And what was that like?
It was again, more trial by fire, right? Let's just grab this guy, throw him off the deep end and see how he does.
So Philippe predates you here.
Yeah.
So did you ask him, hey, what am I getting myself into?
1,000%, right?
Like French speaker to French speaker, what's going on here?
Yeah, and so at this time, he's at Logi, right? So, you know, of course, I kind of connected with him and sort of just asked, like, what is Memory Blue? Yeah. You were there. And, of course, he had positive things to say, right? Yeah. He was like, hey, where I'm at now, what I'm able to do, my success at Logi, and, you know, his success since then to today is all attributable to Memory Blue, right? But you know what I mean?
He spoke highly of Joseph A. Banks.
So you guys grabbed him out of selling suits, right? I didn't tell you guys about the Hot Wheels when Chris Corcoran cold called me, but I was waiting the tables, right? And so for me, like as soon as then we got into that, I was like, okay, let me gear up for this career.
Right.
Because I saw this as like, okay, you know, I go in here and I put my best foot forward, this is the beginning of the rest of my life, right? This is just, I saw it as one of those, you know, hey, platforms, I could be there 3 months, I could be there 10 months, I could be there 18 months, right? And I think, you know, by the end, I was here 10, 11 months. But, you know, that part was exciting too, right? The part that it was like, hey, this is a short-term kind of boot camp, if you will. And from there, I'll really kickstart my tech sales career.
Kind of like an incubator.
Yeah, right. 100%. Yeah,
tech sales incubator.
Yeah, and like, you mean, Philippe, to a certain extent as well, because Philippe with the UEA, was, you know, as a summer job, he's selling Hawkins suits at Joseph A. Banks and getting ready to dress for the workforce, right?
Yeah.
But his old man was in tech sales.
Yeah.
Right.
And public sector too.
Public sector, right? And, you know, your parents were in tech sales, but your ridiculous talent with a work ethic and great perspective and smart on those things, that represents what Chris and I were trying to do with the business. We're still trying to do this day, like getting other people into the business that would not have otherwise gotten in.
Yeah.
But what if you had to pick up your phone?
Yeah.
No, what if with the voice
I'm glad mail, I did, right?
Right? Yeah. What if like Chris and Joey?
Then I would have gotten Joey instead of Chris, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe no one, right? Maybe you'd be successful no matter what, but like you're great for sales. And that's the thing. So when you like, we can talk about this towards the end, I guess. I want to circle back on how we get more Yassines into the business. How you think we should get more of them into the business.
Sure,
right?
Sure, yeah.
But all right, so well, I'm sorry, where were we? So you were here.
So working, coming in, you know, my mentor was Robbie Connors. So the good old Robbie, he's been killing it for a very long time. Yeah, it's Science Logic. He's a company man. But now Rob, you know, I come in and as I mentioned, thrown off the deep end, right? So I inherited a client that was kind of heading towards the red, right? They weren't too happy.
Who was it?
Net, right? Yep, and so it was Avnet supporting NetApp, but for public sector only.
Yep.
And so day three, it's like, all right, listen, we need you to hop on with your mentor, Robbie. You guys are going to tag team this account, and we need to save this thing, right? So we start to have a few good weeks. We really
– who's your BM?
At the time, this was Mishler. So
Mish Daddy,
Michael Mishler, the one and only. So Mishler brought me on and then gave me, you know, and this is when we're all at Boone, right? So Mishler had his whole side operation going on at Boone Boulevard away from the co-founders.
Yes. It's like an offshore tax haven.
I don't know what Mish was doing behind the scenes on the spreadsheets, right? But Mishler brings me over. And Robbie and I, one of the things we did that I think it really goes to how we were successful is that he was also coming sort of onto that account. He wasn't the main person that was there constantly. So I was like, all right, first of all, what does NetApp do? What is the hook? Who are we going to call, right? Because like these guys, they're going to give you, and that's what I realized probably later on in my career. I was naive at the first few days of Memory Blue. Like they're giving you all these people that they can't get, right? And so they're not giving you these low-hanging fruit leads to go after. They're like, oh, we're paying these guys. Give them all these CIOs and all these execs that, you know, no 22, 23-year-old should be calling on and trying to sell to. And that was our list, right? And so it was just kind of, hey, how do we do the research? And with public sector, one of the big things, and I'm still in it today, and I love it, is public, right? Like, it is very apparent if you do your homework when you make a call, whether you have done that, because nobody has time to waste. And in public sector, you know, they only buy in with compelling events. Something's on fire. Something isn't working. End of contract, right? Or you're solving a problem. There's an initiative that you can go after. And so understanding for each of those execs what mattered to them so that when we hit their gatekeeper, when we hit their email inbox, it was very abundantly clear that it was worth providing some time because we could help solve that problem, right? So that was one of the things that Robbie and I did early on to kind of save that. And then, of course, Avnet came and we're like, hey, we'll bring you Hitachi Data Systems Federal. They brought quantum computing, I think, after a while. And so it became this massive account.
Look at this memory. Yeah. Knocking it out.
Yeah. No, and it was fun stuff, right? I mean, it was the winning. Yeah, exactly. Like we were starting to be successful.
You played for a team like Chelsea. You win. That's right.
We're gonna have to say on the record that you know, there is one true massive champion of England. That's Manchester United. I just need to make sure that stays on this podcast.
The Red Devils,
right? So, you know, and the cool part about that was that there was a complementary feel where these different kind of similar technologies, but they all had something they did better than the others, et cetera. They were all having us attack different verticals of government. So that was cool because then that gave me the exposure to like DOD versus civilian versus the other, IC for some, right? And so, and again, it was super exciting. I think from the Avnet perspective, then that account kept growing, right? Even though I think Robbie might have stayed on it a bit longer than me, but then there was an exciting client that came on board that was down to have somebody kind of close minimal, small deals, business, right? And so for me, looking like, all right, where's my growth, right? I was very quick to kind of put my hand up and say, hey, I want one of those roles, right? And at the beginning, it was just one. And then, you know, through success, we were able to grow that. Then I was given some mentees to help bring onto the fold. So Marco Johnson was one that, you know, helped on Avnet, right? Yeah. So he kind of took my spot on Avnet, but also was just such a killer, you know, in terms of just he very early wanted to put in the work to be successful. And, you know, a lot of people want that quick success, right?
Yeah.
He was willing to do the research. And so he was great at that. Didn't do public sector too long, but understood he had to do that to be successful in kind of BD outreach for public sector, right?
Hey, Yassine, so let me jump in real quick. So
yeah.
You talked a little bit about some of the differences in terms of calling different groups within the government.
Yeah.
So some of our listeners are just starting their career in tech sales, mm-hmm. or they're brand new SDRs, or they're thinking about becoming SDRs. Talk a little bit about some of the differences in the Fed space and how it's different, because it's, as someone who's never done Fed, it's all foreign to me.
Yeah.
So educate me and our listeners a little bit about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the toughest things folks will realize is that private sector can go so much quicker and with less folks involved. Right. And so one of those kind of examples for me early on is, you know, I'm seeing, for example, I started first day with Nate Cassa, you know, one of my best friends, best man at my wedding, or not best man, but groomsman at my wedding. I was groomsman at his just now in LA a few months ago.
So. Really? Are you serious?
Yeah. I've got a few more weddings to go through from Emery Blue, so don't worry. That's the first of many.
And you met him here?
We both started on the same day.
So we moved, right?
Yeah. He's now out in Scottsdale, but he was out in San Jose for a while. Yeah. I mean, we did a bunch of trips together over the years.
That's
so
great.
We've remained close, right? But so, for example, he's right next to me calling on Sama. And these other places first, I think there was that one place that got bought out by MarkLogic when we were here. It's Enterprise EDB, or there was some database company that got bought out by MarkLogic. He was on there.
DB Foundation? No, I can't remember.
No. Yeah. And so, but you know, like I'm calling and I'm, you know, doing all of this research and this strategy. And here he is calling. And then like 2 weeks later, he's getting the AE calling. I'm like, hey, we closed that deal. And I'm like, man, I haven't even occurred this meeting yet. Like, what do you mean?
And he was calling commercial.
He was calling commercial. And so I think that's one of the biggest things early on you need to realize is that, and you know, private sector can move quicker.
Yeah.
Public sector, I mean, there's so much that you need to know about, right? Mm-hmm. Not one person is making a decision.
Right.
There are several people you need to sell to. Once you sell the meeting, the deal, et cetera, then you move on to contracting and you're selling and closing the deal another 50 times.
Right.
And so it's a longer process, right? That being said, you really feel like you're solving problems and you're supporting a mission set. And so for me, you know, for folks that are maybe starting out in public sector, I would say, you know, what is their mission? If you're, for example, selling to DOD, and I don't know, you're selling something that has nothing to do with defense, that has nothing to do with protecting American interests through military, through the different arms of the military, then you're probably going to fall on deaf ears.
Yeah.
And so understanding what that mission is, understanding why people are going to give a shit. And that was one of the things that I learned early on. Like, if I write an email, you don't know me, and I'm asking for your time, everybody's busy in this world.
Yeah.
Why are you going to give me your time? And so I think for any new SDR, whether public or private sector, if you read an email or if you listen back to a call and you can't answer that question for yourself, then how can the person who has no idea who you are answer that question and say to themselves, I'm going to give you time? So for me, again, I think for public sector, especially, do the homework, do the due diligence. There are so many pieces of collateral online, 4-year strategy reports mm-hmm. or briefings for the agency, annual reports, et cetera. If you can use a customer's own language from their business plan to tell them how you can affect their day to day, then you are going to be successful. Mm-hmm. You might not close every deal, but you're going to be successful.
I agree. It just reminds me of the old saying, would you buy from you?
Yeah.
And if the answer is no, you got a lot of work to do. Exactly. Because no one else is going to.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
When you were learning the phone game, because you talked about the research aspect of it, which is super critical in all walks of life, but certainly in the Fed side. When you talk about the list building, which is super critical in all aspects of the game, right? Even now.
Yeah, right. Outbound meetings, is right? Outbound. So important.
What were you really good at on the phones on the discovery side that you like, this is like, a, that, you know, this is what I'm good at, like what part of the game?
Yeah, I mean, it very easily I was able to, and not easily, right? But like very quickly, I should say, very quickly I was able to kind of get my sheet music down where it wasn't I was reading off of a script. but more I knew the little, like, almost gates, right? The gates. Like, hey, you pass this gate to go to the next gate, right? The upfront contract. Mm-hmm. If you start a call without the upfront contract, right, you're missing a big piece of, hey, that can probably buy you an extra 2 minutes. And I think every time you pass a gate,
yep,
you buy yourself a minute. You buy yourself a minute, right? And so
you see, thinks it's like a video game. Right?
But whatever you need to do to make a hard job a bit funner, right? Yeah, because let's be honest, like, there are some days you can make 100 calls, not speak to a soul, and there's nothing you could have done about that, right? They didn't pick up the phone. You can't schedule a meeting.
Not a soul. Right?
That's true. And so the way I saw it was, hey, like, first of all, understand your tech. I think if you don't understand what you're representing, then how can they?
Yep.
But also, my big thing was just don't give a lot. Like, I think early on, I gave everything. And then I realized, well, if I give everything, then why are they going to go meet the AE that I'm trying to set up?
Remember when that guy Corcoran called me? He didn't tell me shit.
Exactly, right? And so, and again, for me, though, there's an art in that of, like, turning those questions into, hey, it sounds like there's interest, but also being like, hey, I'm not the guy. Like, I'm the tip of the spear outreach guy. I'm the biz dev guy, whatever your key phrase was there. Yeah. Let me tee something up. And, you know, I also think that depending on who you were talking to, if I was talking to a CIO, I didn't ask for 30 minutes. I asked for 15, and I told my AE that I was representing, you have 15 minutes. This is a CIO. And if he couldn't, you know, present the value prop in 15 minutes, that's between him and his company, right? Yeah. But for me, I also saw the different kind of things where it's like, hey, maybe let's not ask the CIO for 30 minutes, right? But then the other people that are involved in that same decision-making process where you can gather intelligence, those are the folks that you can ask for 30 minutes and get 30 minutes from. So I also took into account who was who in the account.
Smart.
When you're doing all this at Memory Blue and Boone, the wild, we used to joke, I'll bring this to my favorite jokes, is we would say Corcoran would go to California more often than you'd go to Boone. And I would be much farther behind. And we were letting Mike use that as an area to help figure out how he's going to run his California office, which he subsequently opened.
Yep.
Well, who else had some major game there? Besides yourself, who was the best person in the Boone office?
The best person in the Boone office.
Friendships here.
So another French international school transplant, Tommy Udino.
Tommy O,
man. Right? Killing the game at Adobe. I think he just went back. You know, there was a few folks that started in Gallows, came over to Boone, Jay Holt, Adam and Tanti. You know, of course, I've got Sarah Welsh, who kind of was on that the secondary account that is computing with me.
She was
in California. Yep, exactly. Ashley Harding, who then came in, and I was her mentor. And so another wedding story right there. We were at her wedding in July of 21.
You said we. Who's we?
My wife and I. My partner and I, yep. So we went over there. It was fantastic wedding, you know. I forget the name of the city, but it was about probably another 40 minutes south of here in Tysons, near where the wineries are and stuff like that. Absolute beautiful place. It was like a barn kind of set up and just open field.
Ashley Harding,
and she's doing amazing. So, but yeah, those were some of the folks, right? I mean, you know, the cool thing also, I think, with Memory Blue is that I also started to interface a lot with people through the network, you know, so like, you'll chat with people with that commonality of, hey, we both worked at Memory Blue. But, you know, especially at Fed, too, there weren't too many Memory Bluers that were doing Fed in public sector. And so Nelson, Imade, Matt Bright were some folks that I've chatted up with over the years. And I've tried hiring both of them to places like that. So, you know, you know they're solid there. And by the way, I mean, I do have to give a shout out because when I did move accounts and when I kind of then didn't move to California with Mishler, I went under Lee Ryan's leadership, and I think, you know, Lee is definitely somebody that kind of got me more on the straight and narrow, where it was like, all right, you can have fun, but, like, understand, too, that, like, you know, people are watching. You need to be an example. Like, I know you're doing great on your goals, but, like, you can't be sitting there playing FIFA on the Xbox all day, right? And so Lee, I do have to give her so much credit, right? Because, like, I think Lee, where she kind of honed in on me was like, hey, let's start thinking about that next step in your life, right? Like, you're killing it here. Let's figure out where you go next, right? And so, like, she kind of brought me back to the initial reality of, like, hey, this is that jump start that I'm going to go to the next place, and started getting me excited about that. You know, Abigail, I think she recently got married, so I don't know her last name anymore.
Yeah.
But Abby
is Abigail Lacey.
Abigail Lacey to memory blue. Yeah,
I don't know your neither do I.
But no, she again somebody I've almost gone and worked with it for, and vice versa. I've tried recruiting her.
Yep,
I've done some Special Olympics volunteering with her. She's just an amazing person to know and to have in your network. And you know, other folks. Jim Gandolfo was a hustler over in the Boone Boulevard office.
Riding a wave somewhere right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So he was a surfer, man. He was like, every time we want to do something on the week, like, hey, Jim, where you at? Like, oh, I'm in Delaware on the beach, right? So he lived that surfer life.
And it could have been February.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I would not put it past him to have been there in February. But Ruby Escalona, Julie Forbes were also some awesome performers out in the Boone Boulevard office. Man, who else? Mac White. Oh, he went to California. Mac was such a methodical seller. Like, you know, where a lot of us might not have the best organization, turn to Mac. Turn to Mac. So Mac was also, he had started right before me, but was also just somebody that was, you know, you get closer to people that are like similar tenure to you, right? Mm-hmm. You look up to the people that are getting close to the finish line and that are maybe getting hired out, but the people that you kind of join Memory Blue at the same time, you stay close with them. So Mac was somebody that, you know, he sat near me, and so I'd steal best practices from him. He'd steal things from me. Mm-hmm. I think that's also one of the big things about sales and the way the Memory Blue office is designed, right? Like, I would walk around on calls. I mean, it's just something I do. I have to pace around. Mm-hmm. But selfishly also, I'd have like 1 year in, 1 year out for active listening, but also because I wanted to steal that good line that person just dropped on the phone and make it my own. And similarly, people would do the same with what I would say. And I think that is a beautiful part of like imitation is flattery, right? And so I would look to steal things.
It accelerates development too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
It compresses the amount of time for them to be efficient on their own. And that's why we're big believers in people working from the office.
Oh, 100%.
Because for certain roles, you get to your stage in the game, people more experienced, they can do a lot of things from their house.
Right.
But like when you're earlier in your career, when I say early, first 5-7 years, you know, it depends upon your role. So and that's huge for them to learn that.
Yeah.
So when you and Lee were talking about what you wanted to do, and you're obviously successful, and this is the beautiful thing about it, right? Whether people want to believe it or not, like, you wouldn't strike me up knowing you and your personality as like a Fed guy.
Right.
Right? And people in the Fed don't get upset at that. My wife's in the federal sales world. Like, it's just not, right? And that's another thing, too, because people think it's a slow-moving sale, blah, blah, blah. But that's not – that doesn't mean people in Fed sales are slow-moving.
Not at all, right? I think like and I'm a big sports guy, right?
Yeah.
So I think like one of the big sayings I always go by is, you know, if you're not working hard, your competitor, the guy who's number two, or the gal who's number two, right, is working two times harder than you to unseat you, right? Mm-hmm. And whether you're first, fourth, tenth, right? I mean, you're always looking to climb the ranks. And so I think for me, it's just work harder than the next person. If you know that you're not working as hard as you can possibly work, that you're not overturning each rock that you could possibly overturn, I guarantee you somebody's hungrier out there doing that. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to come and take your food, right? I mean, at the end of the day, they're going to take your meal. And so, for me, I do think like my parents working for NGOs, working for a mission-focused company, like I never saw myself doing public sector, but I was able to very quickly, you know, lean on their experiences and kind of their challenges and what they've done throughout their careers to understand kind of, you know, how to be a good partner. Because at the end of the day, I don't see myself as a seller. I see myself as a partner to my customers, right? And I want them to say the same thing. If they think I'm just that sales guy, then I'm doing something wrong too. Because I want them to understand, you know, your problem's my problem. Because if you have a problem and I can't solve it, you're going to look somewhere else to solve it, right? And I can't solve every problem. And I think that's also something, you know, there was a situation where I had to tell somebody, hey, I couldn't solve your problem. Well, I sold him in my next company. Because appreciated that, right?
Story. Yeah, this is a salesmanship.
Yeah.
This is a great story. I get to hear it, but I just tell our listeners a little bit about what happened.
Yeah.
So this is just to clear things up. You're at Memory Blue. You're successful SDR. You're like, you know what? I want to go to federal sales.
Mm-hmm.
And you departed and you went into federal sales.
Yep. So
this is as a federal seller. We're talking about.
Exactly.
You just gave your philosophy on how you sell.
Yeah.
Which is I'm your partner. I'm not a salesperson just trying to stuff licenses down your throat.
100%.
Right?
100%.
So now you're talking about a situation where you. Go ahead. Take it away.
Yeah. I mean, it was a deal at NIH, right? And, you know, we could do 70% of the stuff, but there was a key component that was very important to this customer. Could we work around it and create a Band-Aid on a thing? And I was like, guys, like we will not renew. we will never sell again, right? And so I called this gentleman up and I told him very kind of straightforward, hey, listen, like we can do all of this. We can excel at these parts. But this part that I think you're putting a lot of weight on is probably the part where we're not too strong. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just kind of coming up front, well, he really appreciated that. Sure. So at my next gig, you know, they needed a business process automation platform. Well, they bought it from me. And that was awesome.
Trust.
Exactly. I had built trust where he understood that when he gave me requirements, I was not going to give him fluff and say, put a green check under every requirement, right? I was going to let him know where we could perform strongly and where we could not perform as strongly, right?
Why is that important?
I think that's important because, you know, there are so many stories of solutions that get rip and replaced.
Yeah.
Not because the solution just fell on its feet. It's because it was sold to do X when they were buying Y. Right. And I think for me, having seen those situations and having started in data storage, right, like that's a lot more prevalent. I don't want to ever be ripped and replaced. Like for me, it's just, you know, like I never want to be fired from a job. Like I hold myself to those standards. I never want to be ripped and replaced because I think for me, if that's the case, unless it's something like, hey, you guys grew just so much, became so expensive or whatever. Right. But for the wrong reasons, I never want to put myself in that situation because also in Fed sales, I mean, the DMV is a small place, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so, you know, that word goes around. And so you're only as strong as your reputation.
If it's DMV, we're not talking about the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Right.
We're talking about the District, Maryland, and Virginia. Yeah. Right? And like the community for high tech and Fed is the public sector is small.
Yeah, 100%.
It's not. And folks, there's not a whole lot of movement. I mean, there's movement, but like it's
slower, right? I mean, it's slower. There's better a buying cycle. Yeah.
Because like, what should work is like the person who passed on you first time came back second time because, you know, you don't see that as much in commercial sometimes because people are moving around and those sorts of things. But that guy was a buyer at another place for you.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
So probably was you working at the same place?
Yeah. Working at the same institute at NIH, doing the same thing. I mean, you know, doing the same thing. He was leading IT for that institute. Right. Mm-hmm. And so he still was the guy where once I saw that next opportunity at my next job, which was the previous one, compared to where I'm at now, I jumped on it, right? And I had that leg up because he knew me as that honest guy who didn't sell him a 70% solution, right, mm-hmm. From my previous gig.
That's how you build a career.
That's how you build relationships, right? Yeah. Do the right thing. And I'm a big believer in karma, too, and pay it forward, right? Mm-hmm. Good things are going to happen if you do the right thing.
Yeah. And you're playing a long game.
If you're competitive, driven, and curious, it's time to consider a professional sales opportunity that your future self will thank you for. With an unmatched training program and a tradition of elevating our people, Memory Blue has helped hundreds of successful professionals launch lucrative tech sales careers. You will grow highly marketable skills through ongoing mentorship from seasoned sales leaders while showcasing your abilities for tech industry royalty and some of the hottest startups around. And you'll do it all surrounded by driven, like-minded colleagues immersed in our award-winning company culture. As your tenure progresses, you will attract a host of career options. This includes moving up internally or venturing out into the tech industry, where tech companies pay a premium for Memory Blue experience. We have immediate openings in our offices from coast to coast. Visit memoryblue.com/SDR and apply today.
So you're in the Fed sales world when you're part of Memory Blue. What do you like about it? Because people are SDRs and they're like, man, it seems so far away. Like, when am I going to get to a closing role? What's that like? And we tell people, be patient. Make sure you do it at the right time. So on and so forth. But now that you're there too, what's the role like? And what do you like about it for the folks that are listening that are currently SDRs? We have a public sector team now.
Yeah. No, it's impressive. It is impressive. Oh, but no, it's strategy. For me, I love the strategy. I think, you know, one of the big books to read, and this is my current VP for public sector that put this on my radar and that I read recently, The Art of War.
Okay.
It is a very easy book to read. I mean, when I tell you, it's like little bullet points with three sentences, mm-hmm. but, you know, fail to plan to fail. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have a plan, if you're just shooting darts on the wall and Fed, you're not going to be very successful because you're probably going to talk to two people when 10 are making the decision. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of strategy involved. And for me, I love that. Going back to the entrepreneurial spirit, right? I get to work with a team, with a solutions architect, with a, you know, an engineer, a customer success manager, all of these various resources. And I love being able to work as a team collaboratively. and align towards a common goal, right? And I think that also comes from just kind of my background in team sports, right? I'm a team player. I love being a part of the team. And I, again, just to quote my current sales leader, right? I mean, it's don't win alone, don't lose alone, right? And so you never want to be a single point of failure, but you also want to understand that, like, I am not going to know all the answers. I'm not going to have all the perspectives, and I'm not going to have all the same perspectives. And having different ones and all coming together to figure out that strategy together, there's something powerful in there. And it's super fun when you do win an exciting opportunity, an exciting contract, right? That camaraderie, the team vibe that you have in terms of celebrating the hard work. I mean, it's super rewarding, right? It's like you won the league title at the end of the year, the championship, you won the playoffs, right? And then you go back and do it all over again for the next one. But for me, I think for folks that are maybe antsy, right? What I would say is just, especially if you're going into public sector, you are always learning. Like, you are always learning. I'm learning something new every day. I had somebody at my previous gig came out of the Pentagon after 28 years of service, was still learning stuff, acronyms, et cetera, at the end of his career, right? So, and that's somebody who's on the inside. So I will say, don't squander the fact that right now you don't have a number above your head and that you can learn a lot and make yourself that much sharper as you then go into a closing role and hold it back. Because let's be honest, it's exciting, but it can also be, you know, the beginning of the end, right? And you having to polish your resume and look for something new. And so, you know, I'm looking back at this now from where I am, not having had this perspective as a younger me. But I think we all, and I was the same, right, guys? I wanted that closing role.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, small amounts of closing is great to build that experience. But for Fed, I mean, just take advantage of the fact that you are in a safe environment and are able to learn more. Because again, right, especially as you're starting your career, it's not as easy as like 10 years down the road. You've built relationships. You understand it a lot more. So you are going to struggle early on as you try to kind of kickstart, you know, being an outside salesperson.
Right. So you've been closing deals for years.
Yeah.
And you've got a lot of perspective. And you talked about winning.
Yeah.
What's your favorite win?
Okay. Yeah, I've got one. So I've got one and I've got a brutal loss that was
we want to hear about both of them.
Okay. Okay. I'll start with the win then.
Yeah.
So the win was, you know, I was working for a company that was really the challenger in the market, right?
Yeah.
And the market leader really had a firm kind of foothold within the market. You know, I was working with a reseller and I was doing everything. And then probably a month and a half before the end of September, which is the end of the government fiscal year. So by then they've made a decision, they're buying it, they've got to spend the money. I'm starting to hear that the reseller is potentially going to sell the market leader.
So you work at a manufacturer.
Yep.
You brought in a reseller.
Yep.
And you're getting whispers that the reseller that you brought into the deal is going to sell the market leader.
Exactly. Okay? And so, you know, there were some salient characteristics. The leader was saying that they could do them, but I had a patent for one. And so based on what I know from the research I did with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, there's this 10-year gap between when somebody gets a patent and when others can then, you know, basically mimic that technology so that nobody really has a lifetime monopoly on something, right? It's about 2 years after the patent.
Okay.
So I just basically told the contracting officer in the Corps, contracting officer representative, well, listen, there is no other solution on the market that can do 0.3 out of the many salient characteristics you have in your RFP, because here is the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office saying we are the only ones with a patent on it.
Yeah.
And so I won that deal because of that, although the customer even was trying to go to the market leader as well. And so, and of course, that was because the reseller was guiding them there.
Yeah. I hope you took the deal direct.
I definitely did. You know, at that point, it was too late in the game, right?
Yeah.
It was too late in the game. We were set up to take it. And so we took it down. We took it down. And actually, to give props to another alum, I had a soup contract holder because my company didn't have a NASA soup contract at the time. It was a gentleman by the name of Mo Hassan working at DH Tech in Leesburg. So, you know, I definitely owe my boy Mo a call here. We've got to catch up. But
Did Mo procure the deal?
So Mo is the one who actually closed the deal as the prime. Yeah. I was the actual seller behind it, right? So Mo and I actually closed probably like half a dozen deals together.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was a fun relationship.
Did you know Mo when he worked at Memory Glue?
Yeah. So he was on Tommy Gassman's team, I want to say.
Yep.
And I think the sales team, right? Yep. Tommy Gassman's sales team. So, but he was here, and then I think he got towards the end of his tenure and then kind of just went out and went to DH Tech, which was closer to him as well, living wise.
Yep.
But he played we had the soccer team. I had put together, the Memory Blue soccer team in 2015. So we had Mo played goalie a few times, and then Toby Hartle played only a few times. And that was another guy that, you know, I will say, like, Kobe was my age now when he was at Memory Blue. And I think that the important lesson for anybody either listening or that's maybe, you know, early 30s thinking, like, I don't want to be an SDR. I mean, my brother is 40 and he just, you know, he's about to be a year of being an SDR for an OEM. Yep. It's never too late. I mean, if you apply yourself and learn the skill, it's never too late. I mean, a lot of people change careers and industries completely, you know, at ages that aren't the norm, right? And I think just don't listen to the norm, right? Yeah. There is no norm. There is no, if there was a norm to live life, you'd get the book when you were born, right? And so I think Toby's kind of story was a great one too, because as a young guy seeing that, it showed you like, oh my God, I'm doing this at this age.
Yeah.
Well, like, man, I can't wait to see what I'm doing when I'm Toby's age, right? And so that's cool to see and know about as a young kid coming out of school and so looking to get their feet under them.
So definitely. I got a question for you. For two things, that's one quick point.
Yeah.
And we have people like that, like Toby or your bro, who are in the game a little bit later on in life. I always tell them that, look, all this other experience is going to serve you so well in the next role.
Yeah.
And even better in the role after that. Doesn't mean it's not helping you now, but you just kind of have to prove yourself, say what you want about it, get in your foot in the door, just it's like to get through the dip, those sorts of things. What you just said, though, was like we're constantly trying to improve the business and make it a place where people can learn and succeed and excel. And there's a lot more support.
Yeah.
And demonstrated success. Now there was when you worked here, and it was just like Austin, 75 people in the total of the company.
75 people in 2015, including the Austin office.
Including the Austin office. No California office, no alum of the year, no public sector group, no academy training. And we've software companies pay us to train their people now.
Oh, wow.
All sorts of shit. Why do you think some people look at Toby, who's a badass in his own right?
Yeah.
And say, and you're like, man, I'm early in here. I must be on to something. I got to take this serious. Why do some people see that and recognize that as like, this must be a tremendous opportunity if a guy like Toby's doing this and I'm younger? And other people like get it twisted or like get off the path. Like, why?
It's your mindset, right? I mean, at the end of the day, your mind is the most powerful part of your body. You could be lifting 600 pounds at the gym. It does not matter. You know, I go by the Navy SEALs rule too, the 40% rule. Mm-hmm. The first time you try to stop and give up on something, whether you're running a marathon, and I do not run marathons, but whatever you're doing, something challenging, right? The first time your body wants to give up, your mind, your body's actually at 40% energy expended. Mm-hmm. So you still have over 50% to go, right? And this is, I'm blanking on the guy, David Goggins or something like that. And great books to read, right? Because he's a motivational guy. I mean, like literally the story where I heard this was these people were running like 100-miler and it was teams. And then there was one guy running it by himself who broke like every bone in his foot and was just eating saltine crackers as he kept going. And it was the Navy SEAL 40% rule guy. And so I think it's all about mindset. If you want me to convince you why something is not a good idea, I will always be able to, the same way I can convince you it is a good idea. And so if you always want to talk yourself out of it or not see the positive, you're always going to be able to. So at the end of the day, it's all about mindset. When you wake up in the morning, whatever your morning routine is, I challenge that person, get into the right mindset. Is it listening to that playlist, that album, that whatever? Blocking the first hour of your calendar to not be on calls and listen to music. Whatever gets you in that right mindset, you want to see things from that mindset.
That's good advice. So to take us to this is also good advice, right? Lesson learned. Like
biggest loss.
Most haunting. Yeah. And this was actually at Memory Blue. So I, you know, I'm like kind of SDR inside sales rep, right?
Yep.
For the vendor at Landis
Computing.
Yep. And so EMC is at Walter Reed. And, you know, this is array, hardware storage arrays, right? And the business model for all these companies is you buy the array, 3 years later, the maintenance and support for that old array is more expensive than a new array.
Right.
So, you know, these EMCs, these NAPs, they were just continuously just installing new storage arrays, right? And government agencies would just allow the maintenance and support to lapse. And so, of course, I'm coming in like, you know, oh my God, I've got this technology, it's software defined, right? And we're not only are we going to show you that it performs better for you than your current environment and what you have, but we're going to also be able to give you all of this for a cheaper price point. We did a POC. We proved both of those elements. What I did not know at the time was that the EMC guy and whoever that decision maker was, because again, SDR, right? I wasn't in the POC. I just teed things up. They went to college together. They had, you know, monthly dinners. And so I was never going to unseat that guy, even if I could give all of these advantages, right? And so very early on, I realized I need to know about the internal politics. That probably wasn't the person we wanted to run the POC with.
Yeah.
Because that person kept control and made sure that, and I don't know what happened, right? But probably made sure that maybe the data that we actually recorded off the proof of concept didn't make it to, you know, these higher levels. Why? Because his vested interest was, well, the EMC guy takes care of me. He's my boy. And so understanding that there are these things to know, I think that's key too, right? And so that was a massive, you know, kind of punch in the gut for me because, you know, I'm naive still at this point where I'm thinking, well, if I give you something better for cheaper, right?
Like, what did you do?
why would you not jump on that? But, you know, I learned the hard way that, you know, there's a lot more to kind of peel back and figure out before you even get in the door, right? And so that was a tough loss for me. That was a tough loss for me early on.
What I liked too, the lesson learned, I noticed you said we never would have won the deal, but like it probably wasn't the best person to work the POC with.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. There's a nuance in that. A lot of people are like, we never would have won this deal anyways. That's like kind of throwing your hands up.
You don't know that.
Right. Yeah. And that's like abdicating all your responsibilities as a sales professional when the reality is that probably wasn't the best person.
Yeah,
because you got to figure out how to neutralize that person.
Yeah.
Or do it with somebody else or like get out in front of them.
100%.
But you know, 100%. Everybody's assuming they got the deal done. Right? It's coming in, Chris. It's coming in.
Verbal.
So how about this? You're a smart guy. Understand the space. Mm-hmm. Not that you're looking to move opportunities, but people probably come to you or you're evaluating technologies in the marketplace. When you're evaluating where you work now, what's important to you in a role?
Yeah, I mean, for me, where I work now, so I work for a company named Chainalysis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of my dreams when I came to Memory Blue, or at least my initial goal, was like, I'd love to join a rocket ship at an early stage. Mm-hmm. So you get there early enough and you're part of the building. I've always had that picture of like, you know, we're all over there on Wall Street, ringing the bell, going public. Yeah. That was at least what I have in my brain to like, you know, continue to truck towards that goal. And so I'm super excited where I'm at. Again, I have a personal attribution to what we do, you know, mentioning the smartphone and the global kind of economy story earlier. So, you know, when I joined, we were about 150 employees. I've been there 2.5 years. We're past 800 now.
Wow.
We've gone from like a $200 million valuation over $8.6 billion in a valuation. Oh. So, you know, I already feel so fulfilled with what I've been able to help contribute and what we've done together as a company and as a team over the last 2.5 years. And I'm very excited for the next 2.5 years, right? So that part's been exciting. We do crypto and blockchain data. So we're a crypto and blockchain data company. And are the market leader, right? And so I've always worked for the challenger, and it's kind of awesome to work for the leader now and kind of help grow our footprint, right, across both private and public sector globally. So that part's been exciting. I mean, looking towards the future, I think I've always sort of had this split in my career where I maybe then like, hey, let's just go for it, move to Europe somewhere, take on either, you know, you either build a team or you take on a new kind of vertical or something to that effect, right? Maybe if you're at a smaller startup, maybe it's not this company. They're like, hey, we want to send you to start the region in Europe, et cetera. Because with my background, I mean, I've got family over there, et cetera. And then with my background, I feel like I can probably do a pretty solid job. I mean, I speak French, I speak Spanish, speak Arabic, I speak English, right? And so with those four languages, you can hit a good amount of like Europe, you can hit North Africa, you can hit the Middle East. And so I'd love to see, you know, if I can be successful in a role like that. So I'd probably see that at some point being maybe a future move. Mm-hmm. That being said, I mean, I still just love where I'm at now with Chainalysis. I'm just as excited to get out of bed on day, not whatever it is, 900 as day one. And I love supporting, you know, the government mission right now. I think for us, the cool thing is like we are actually helping solve our government's problems and attributing ourselves to supporting that mission. And so for that part is super exciting. So
how did you pick that opportunity though, right? Like you're still relatively early in your career.
Yeah.
Lots of companies are coming at you.
Yeah.
Trying to get you. How do you size up? And this is advice for someone who's coming out of Memory Blue, who's sizing up an opportunity, or maybe somebody who's that Memory Blue, they're going on to their second. Like, what do you look at?
Yeah, no, I mean,
because all these companies, we're well funded. We got this, particularly in Fed, because Chris and I used to say about Fed, or we still say a lot of times in Fed, you don't want to be the first guy either.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
That's true. It's tough. Yeah.
But talk about that. Out of all these companies that have made it, because a lot of companies don't, mm-hmm. what do you look for?
Yeah, I mean, for me, first, the technology. Mm-hmm. The technology, can I sound passionate selling it, right? And talking to it, because again, right, you hear if somebody's pissed or if somebody's excited over the phone. And now in our world with Zoom and video conference, right, you see these people. So for me, it's, hey, do I believe in that technology? That's probably the number one thing. I also think, again, like looking at, to your point, like how many people are on the team? How much did you guys close last year? What is my quota going to look like, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you guys closed $1 million last year, my quota is $4 million. Well, I'm probably not going to be successful. And I know, right. But I say this because, you know,
it happens.
I've seen, like, to your point, the First Fed folks, right? I've seen people get super excited when I was in the reseller world. They'd come and they'd be like, yeah, we're so excited. This is the best thing since sliced bread. We'd ask them, like, what's your number for the year? 10 mil. Well, next year they were at different companies because yeah. they had never closed a deal in Fed, and suddenly they had a 10 mil number, right? Yeah. And so for me, there's the realities. Am I actually going to have what I need to be successful? Are the goals even realistic, right? And then, you know, I always talk to some folks before I commit to anything. So I'll try to talk to another AE. I'll of course, you know, through my interview process, talk to the sales leader, et cetera. Yeah. But I'll try to talk to other people in other cross-functional teams just to get a better idea. Because, again, when you go through an interview process, that company can do nothing wrong, right? Well, I want to know from the people actually that have been there 2-3 years, like, hey, are you just as excited to be there, right? So this company, Chainalysis, I mean, that is what I saw across the board. I was reached out to on LinkedIn, and, you know, I wasn't looking. So, you know, I wasn't looking, but I heard and got into kind of crypto blockchain as a hobby really in late 2017. And so I've got the head recruiter reaching out to me for the crypto blockchain analysis market leader. And I sat there and I said, there is no way I can at least give her some time to see what this is all about, right? And she hooked me, right? She knew what she was doing. She hooked me. She had a great messaging, right? I thought I was speaking to somebody else. So I was on the call like, hey, where's Chris? Like, you know? and she's like, yeah, that's the next step, buddy, right? Like,
she blew Chris away.
But she used him to get the hook. Right? We had a great conversation. And even then, to your point, right? She kind of was like, hey, just FYI, like, you'd be the youngest guy on the team. And for me, I'd seen so many. I don't like to make it like an age thing, right? Because I've seen so many different folks from different walks of life at different points in their life be successful. But my response to that was just like, listen, like, I am a hunter. I'm hungry. And, you know, like, for example, where I was at, I've seen a few folks that have come in and, you know, hey, I know everybody, and then like a year later, they're gone because it was just all fluff, right? And so I just kind of said, like, yeah, do I have a massive Rolodex? No. But, you know, here's what I've done throughout my trajectory. And, you know, I had to sell myself too. And for this opportunity, I really wanted it. Yep. They didn't know that till the end, right? I had to play hard to get, but like, I really wanted it. And so when I got hit with like that question or two from left field, you know, I answered in the right way, which was just, hey, I don't even care about that because what I'm going to bring is a hunter's mentality, outbound prospecting that I was taught here, and the work ethic, right? The hunger to succeed. So, I mean, that's kind of how I got to Chainalysis.
What did you just say about you kind of played hard to get to the end?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and there's a few
people listen don't know what you mean by that.
there's a few different reasons, right? I mean, I had this massive deal that was closing. Yeah. And so I was also trying to slow play it so I could close that deal and then go over, right?
Yep.
And of course, you know, they needed the resource, so they got to push back and were just like, hey, no, we need you on this day. And I ended up going, right? But, you know, you don't want to show that you were just absolutely like, I want this job. And so, you know, like I was, of course, not looking. But then I very quickly had to find another interview or two because if I'm just interviewing at this one spot, I don't know what I'm comparing against. I haven't interviewed in 3 years.
Right.
Yeah. The salary you're offering me, is that fair?
Yeah.
The comp you're offering me, is that fair? Like, you know, if I don't have anything to compare it to, then it's just how I feel. Well, you could give me a number I feel great about, but then if I had the comparison and that number was higher, I probably wouldn't feel as good.
Yeah.
And so because of that, you know, I'd found a few other technology companies that were also super exciting that I started an interview process with and then quickly ended it, right? Up front, like, hey, I've accepted this offer of employment. Let's not continue moving forward. But, you know, with Chainalysis and the recruitment process, I had to be kind of, hey, because now I've got this ongoing, I am kind of, you know, exploring the waters to see what else is out there. And it allowed me to get the best offer for myself, for myself, my family, right, et cetera.
So a couple of things I want you to unpack and for the listeners, because this is important and you've got the perspective of doing it. So you talked a little bit about market working for or selling for the market share leader versus selling for the challenger. Talk about that. Which do you prefer? Which one's easier? Which one more challenging?
I mean, I think everybody should be on both sides.
Yeah.
I do think like you learn so much being on both sides. I think from the market leader perspective, you always have a target on your back. So everything you do, if you think of things in that manner, you can't be complacent. You got to keep pushing the envelope. You got to keep innovating. You got to listen. Like, that is probably the most important thing. You have to listen. I literally, this is a home project, right? But like, we literally had a scenario, you know, where we just kind of needed a small thing done. And we had done 80% of it with a terrible vendor, but we were fine with 80%. We wanted the final 20% done. This new vendor wanted to sell us a new 100% solution. They were like, we don't want to inherit this. They didn't listen, right? And so they didn't get our business at the end of the day. For me, it's listening. If my customers tell me that these three things are going to allow them to, you know, have more greater positive outcomes, then I am hounding my internal teams to provide me those three things, whether it's product innovation, whether it's more resources, whether it's subject matter experts around a certain field, whatever it is, right? When I get a new quota and a bigger number, well, I say, well, if you can give me that bigger number, I need these three things, though, right, to be successful. I think listening is the number one thing, because if you don't listen, your competitor is going to listen.
So working for a market share leader, you can't be complacent.
Can't be complacent.
Everyone's gunning for you.
Yeah.
So what's the good thing about working for a market leader?
Well, it's proven, right? So it's proven. Yeah. So there are going to be some times where, you know, folks are just going to come directly to you. You're going to have a lot more inbound opportunities.
Right.
But also, you know, folks are going to talk about you, right? And so you're going to have that word of mouth that goes around. And so if you do things in a good manner and you constantly exceed expectations, that word gets around, right? So that part is super exciting, because a lot of times you don't need to introduce as much the company as much as what the company can do for them.
Right. The old, no one ever got fired for going with IBM.
Yeah.
So that's the market share leader. What was great about selling for a challenger?
Yeah. So selling for a challenger, it's super fun as well, right? Because again, like, the wins are fewer and far between, but when you get the wins, they're that much just funner to celebrate, right? I think it's scale. What I learned is that you might be in one out of every 10 deals your competitive counterpart is.
Yeah.
So if I'm selling, I'm just going to take a random example to like the Department of Justice. Well, he might have 10 deals with the Department of Justice, whereas I'm just competing with him again on the one.
Wow.
And so, you know what I mean? Like, you have less at bats to make a mark. And understanding that, it's also like, I'm the kind of guy, I want to go after everything.
Yep.
And you have to understand where you have more chances of winning if you don't have the right resources to go after everything.
Yep.
That being said, it's a lot of times just also working late nights and kind of piecing together RFQ, RFI responses, and at least just trying to get my name in as many hats as possible. But from the challenger perspective, I would say it's probably the biggest thing, right, is that you have less opportunities than the people you are fighting against to win the customer's business.
I see. Okay. So good. What about, you've worked with technology manufacturers versus for resellers?
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, Memory Blue, reseller to OEM, right? That's like kind of the progression. And so I got exposure to the reseller world first.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, like, the reseller I was at was not your classic reseller, right? They were very much also like almost a mom and pop shop federal systems integrator.
Yeah.
A ton of cleared and badged engineers that could really go in, do help support the work, and also be boots on the ground for us within the customer's environment. That being said, right, I think like the main thing that kind of then made me say, like, all right, I'm ready for my next move, is that I knew a little bit about a lot to be dangerous.
Yeah.
And I wasn't an expert in anything.
Right.
And for me, I wanted to be able to kind of attach my name to what I was doing and be an expert at that. Right. And you're never an expert 3 months in, 6 months in. I think like a lot of times we want to be an expert. It's a constant progression of, you got to put in the work and the time to become an expert. Like, I feel like with where I'm at now, it probably took a year and a half to actually really feel like, all right, you got everything down. Right. Mm-hmm. That being said, within the first 3 months, I mean, I got a lot of the main stuff down. But there's so much you could figure out. And then there's always pushing the envelope, where you can also help shape where we go, because you're listening to customers. You're on the front lines. And so if you bring those challenges to your team to try to find solutions, you can also help shape where we're going. And then you're almost, you know, you're involved with that idea, and you're already an expert on day one or as you progress from that. Right. And so I think for me, it was just being able to actually kind of represent a technology, products, and a company as an expert, rather than just knowing a little bit enough about many technologies to be dangerous.
So let's see. You see, I made a prediction about what you were eventually going to do.
Okay.
Do you remember this?
This
is me. This is me remembering.
Now this is, we come full circle.
Yeah, we come full circle. So, I mean, is there a better EMEA rep? So for the listeners that don't know, EMEA, Europe, Middle East, Africa.
Yep.
Yassine speaks English, French, Spanish, Arabic, right?
Right.
Understands technology. Yeah, understands how to sell.
You can hire Philippe.
Understands.
But Philippe might not come work for me.
understands how to sell for a challenger as a market share leader, understands direct sales, and understands the channel. And yet he's selling to the federal government. But my prediction is one day, EMEA.
Yeah, and you know, I want to make it happen. You know, for my, you know, we were super lucky, like for our wedding back in 2019, we got married in Malaga, Spain, fell in love with the city. It is also like when you look at the cost of living here in Washington, D.C. versus there, it's absolutely insane, right? Yeah. So like we could see ourselves moving there.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, she's Venezuelan, Paraguayan, but, you know, the roots come from Spain. And so, you know, we've kind of seen that. The U.K. is definitely a possibility with my brother, my sister-in-law, my nephew living there. Algeria being that much closer to extended family. So I will say it'll probably happen. I think the prediction is, will it last?
You know, so you got to look at all the people who are self-federal government.
Yeah.
Right? You can do what they can do, right? But the EMEA thing, there's so few people that can do everything that you have, mm-hmm. right? Fluency in all those languages. That's like
the outbound shop.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yes.
You know, sometimes people kind of rest in their laurels.
Right.
That level of just sophistication.
So that's my. I'm sticking to that prediction. We'll see if it ever happens, and we'll have to
knock it on wood
back.
Here. Yeah.
We got
to
get.
I'll invite you guys to Europe. For
there
the,
you
the,
go.
The episode two, right?
The road show.
That'd be awesome.
What about you guys? I mean, is that a market you guys are?
Oh yeah.
Well, right.
Yeah.
I imagine.
Yeah, we want to take our game to the international stage.
Absolutely. Germany is definitely a first stop for you, Ganya.
We have clients that ask us all the time. Hey, can you guys do something overseas?
Nice.
And we refer the work typically.
Okay.
But we could, there's a demand for it.
Yeah.
There's a need. It's a little bit different. So I don't know, when you get over there, we can be one of your customers.
Right. Bring us in, you see.
Would love to.
All right, man. So between now and then, we have to get a bunch of those people in the podcast that he mentioned.
Yeah.
And then we can do that. We'll circle back with you and we'll see where you are.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, absolutely. You know, and again, some of the people, like I mentioned, right, that I worked alongside of here, wedding, stuff like that. I mean, you know, my wife's friends with their significant other, et cetera. Right. I mean, it's, you build lifelong relationships here at Memory Blue. I mean, I even Dima Abubakar, right? I mean, I saw her, Dima, like a great, great friend, right? And I saw her come to Memory Blue many years after I left, exchange messages, right? And I think the network is awesome, right? Because I think there's a willingness to want to help others succeed. Yeah. You know, as I had mentioned, Nelson, Philippe, these are all people way before my time, right? Yeah. So Hale, the first alumni of the year. I was here at the first one, right? That was 2015. And so, you know, we've had a couple of conversations over the years.
Sure.
So it's a great network, especially public sector. There's only a few of us, although I see now that there's a whole public sector team here. We'll be able to welcome a lot more folks into the public sector Memory Blue Network.
Yes.
So, but it's, you know, I thank you guys because these are some of the lifelong friends that I've got and that, you know, we stay close with. And, you know, I wouldn't have met them if I didn't get cold called by Chris and come join you guys at Memory Blue. And so,
wow.
Very good.
All right. So before we close it out, knowing what you know now, what would you have told yourself the night before you started at the company? So your 22-year-old self, 23-year-old self?
Yeah, it's a woof. That's a great question. Man. Wow.
Married. You have a beautiful child.
Yeah.
Right? You got these big dreams and hope you're still going to take out. You know? But what would you have told yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I probably would have told myself, this is absolutely going to be a fun experience, but that's going to absolutely change your life. And probably, you know, hey, come in every day with that much more of the hunger to learn, right? I think like I did well, and then kind of, you know, there's great amenities here at Memory Blue and whatnot, and so I'd have fun with. Of course, I was in the wild, wild boom, wild, wild west, right? But I would say, for me, right? And I super build, so I worked 60 hours a week. Yep. Like I wasn't somebody who shied away from doing the work.
Yeah,
I think for me it was just, you know, like for example, I would have tried to learn that much more. I didn't know where I was going, right? So I would have tried to learn that much more public sector so that as I really got into that closing role, I would have been, you know, a bit more successful, right? I mean, I will say if you make that growth, right, that leap up towards closing, you need to be ready for some growing pains. And it hits you hard, right? Yeah. Because you want to be successful. You're putting in the work. And again, I think that's the biggest thing is, you know, soak in as much as you can here without the added pressures of a number hanging above your head. You know, I love to be a startup guy because I don't want to be number 1,846. I want to be Yassine, that guy who works hard.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so for me, it's understanding that, hey, this is an area where you can have fun, but you also, it's like your training ground before you go onto the stage, right? Or onto the pitch or onto the field, right? And so for me, it's, yeah, apply yourself here as much as you can because you're not going to have as much time when you have all of these things. You got to do forecasting. You got to let your leadership know what's coming in when and how and what why do you think that's happening, right? That takes away from the time you have to do your research. Mm-hmm. And so learn as much as you can here is probably the one thing I would have told myself the night before I started here.
All right. That's great. Very good. Yassine,
thanks for stopping
by. Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Lots of fun.
No, such a pleasure.
Very good. Thanks.
If your sales team struggles to hit quota or generate qualified leads, Memory Blue's Academy Prospecting Principles Training Program is the solution. Great sales training is time intensive and requires continuous guidance from sales experts. In this 6-week course, our world-class facilitators use a hands-on learning approach to turn raw talent into industry-leading salespeople. From building targeted outreach lists to strategically overcoming objections, the key prospecting skills taught here create the foundation for strong sales performance. Our proven training cuts SDR ramp time in half and increases quota attainment by 89%. New cohorts launch twice per month. Head to memoryblue.com/academy to see upcoming dates and secure your seat today.
Thanks for listening to Tech Sales is for Hustlers. Please subscribe and leave a 5-star review after the beep.